episode 10 of Top Turtle MMA. Holy crap, we made it 10 episodes. Episode 10 of Top Turtle MMA is brought to you by Sisu Mouthguards. Sisu Mouthguards, the most breathable, lightweight, strongest, durable, comfortable, hygienic, and remoldable mouthguards on the marketplace. Gumby, talk to the people about Sisu.
So Sisu mouthguards are great if you're a grappler or an MMA fighter. I use my Max Guard when I'm on the mats.
High-impact sports.
They're also great for team sports. So I have an Aero Guard for when I'm playing indoor soccer because I play that from time to time. And that's really great because when you're running around, it gives you plenty of breathing room.
And if you are under 17 and can't get into an R-rated movie on your own, you're going to want to go ahead and get yourself the Junior Guard. It's for youth sports. So Sisu Mouthguards brings you episode 10 of Top Turtle MMA. The music is back. We are rolling. This is Top Turtle MMA. It's episode 10. I am David Tremonti, your co-host. I am joined by Daniel Gumby Vreeland. How are you today, Dan?
I'm good. Much better with the music back because, let me tell you, it felt a little weird listening to last week's episode without the trademark music.
We had some audio malfunctions. We had some editing malfunctions, but we pushed through. We survived. We lived to fight another day. Hey, we're like Conor McGregor. We took a shot. I will not fault us for taking a shot.
I never fault us for taking a shot.
So we are Top Turtle MMA. You can email us topturtlemma@gmail.com, and you can follow us on the social media site all the kids love, Twitter @topturtlemma. Gumby, where can people catch you?
You can get me at Gumby Vreeland on the Twitter, and if you're interested in reading articles about MMA, which I'm guessing if you're here you do, you can head over to MMA-manifesto.com. Check out stuff written by me, stuff written by Dave, stuff written by the head of the site, Jeff Fox, and all kinds of other very, very talented writers.
Is he related to Michael J. Fox?
He is not. I can assure you he's not.
All right. Well, where we're going, we don't need any roads. It is another day in the MMA landscape. We have some UFC 200 rumors, and we have a free agent signing with Bellator. Where do you want to start, Gumby?
Let's start with Bellator, because, you know, I have to honestly say that I'm happy for Matt Mitrione signed with Bellator. I guess earlier this morning was when it was announced.
Yeah.
And good for him. You know, like, I thought when he lost that fight to Travis Brown, you know, you're starting to think, okay, his contract's up. You know, who could he possibly fight next in the UFC? And he's getting older.
He's 37.
Yeah, you couldn't imagine the UFC paying him very much or treating him very well in the way of matchups. So, like, I think it makes sense to be at Bellator. I would watch him fight Shek Kongo, like, tomorrow if he, you know, they booked that. And that's, like, a fun yet meaningful fight in their heavyweight division.
Right. So, now, let's not overstate it. It's not, you know, if they had gotten Overeem.
Yeah, yeah. It's not a big coup of any sort.
He's not a needle mover. But I guess I'll ask you this. Do you think the additions to Bellator, you know, your Bensons, your Matt Mitrione's recently and before that, or even actually you can almost say Rampage goes back to Bellator, punches and bunches, Nate Diaz style, is it starting to add up? Are they gaining momentum with some of these signings, or you just don't see the pieces in place yet?
I don't see the pieces in place yet. I mean, like, Benson Henderson's a big one, and I think they should get props for getting Benson Henderson over. But when you think about Rampage is over because he tried to get out of his contract and he couldn't. That doesn't look good for Bellator. I mean, like, they're going to see him fight a couple more times in Bellator. As a matter of fact, I bet you he tries to wear out his contract with Ryzen instead of Bellator because they've got that reciprocating deal, and he loves fighting in Japan.
Yeah.
So, like, why not fight over there and use his contract over there? He's made it pretty clear that he wants to be in the UFC. So, like, while he's fighting for Bellator and he will get them some ratings, it's not like that piece that's going to make you be like, oh, Bellator's actually competing with the UFC.
Now, it's worth mentioning as well, Bellator, with the nice move, I guess you could call it, getting Matt Mitrione away from the UFC. Kimbo popped for steroids, as did Ken Shamrock. They'll probably both be suspended. I don't know what were the old, because they just go by the commission rule book. So what was the penalty for a steroid pop? Like, it wasn't even a full year, was it? No,
I don't think it was.
Okay, but it puts them on the shelf for a little bit.
Yeah, but, like, you know, how quick was Kimbo going to fight again anyway? I mean, like, and we already talked about the fact that it, like, wasn't, like, mind-blowing. Nobody's demanding to see another Kimbo fight ever again.
But they popped a huge rating on Kimbo versus Dodd.
Okay, but we talked about that, too, about the fact that I think it did more harm than good. You know, like, the legend of Kimbo is no more, really. You know what I mean? Like, everybody being like, Kimbo Slice is this guy who can knock anybody out. No, he's this guy who took three rounds to knock out a guy whose heart was failing and he was exhausted. I mean, like, and he still couldn't really put him away. So, in addition to that, it was just, I mean, just sloppy fighting. So, like, I don't think anybody's demanding a Kimbo fight ever again.
This goes back to what I said a couple episodes, I think, which is I wish they would just pick a division and just make that the goal, to just have that division be their standout division. Right now, they're just piecemealing whoever they could get from the UFC. Ellenberger will probably come over in, you know, a couple of months. He's I think he already has been released by the UFC.
I saw that they deleted his page off of the UFC.com website.
So all but gone.
Yeah, I follow this bot on Twitter that, you know, says when things get deleted, and it said Jake Ellenberger deleted. So, I think that's a sign that he's probably on the way out.
All right, so I think we can wrap this up by just saying Matt Mitrione, good for him. He's going to get paid, but at the end of the day, it is what it
is. Yeah, I mean, it's just another guy getting his paycheck. That's all.
All right. So more fun is UFC 200 rumors. We're real rumor mongers ourselves. And a couple of things have come out since we last spoke, you know, right after the 196 fallout. And we were just kind of whistling Dixie, as they say, and putting our most educated guesses out there. And while nothing's been confirmed, you had a couple of different pieces of info come out. One, I think it was confirmed that McGregor is going to fight at 200. I don't think there was a medical suspension that would preclude him from doing that.
No, he wasn't. I'm pretty sure he wasn't suspended at all, although I know Diaz was suspended.
Till 420.
Till 420.
How apropos. And so McGregor wants to turn around for 200. And then Dana White, I think they're kind of putting feelers out there right now. The obvious play here, and we already broke it down, so we don't have to go into it too much today, but it's going to be a featherweight title defense against the former champion Jose Aldo, who Conor just beat in 13 seconds in December, or the more deserving of the two, Frankie Edgar, who is coming off a brutal knockout win over Chad Mendes. You know, White over the weekend, I think it was an interview with ESPN, if I'm not mistaken, basically said, I think the fans are really hungry to see Frankie Edgar fight for the title. And that, to me, was Dana White kind of just testing the waters to see what the reaction would be to him saying, yeah, you know, Frankie has a lot of momentum there.
Yeah, well, and I think some of that, too, is, yeah, he is trying to test the waters. But there's some truth to that, too. You know, he's the everyman's kind of fighter. You know, like, everybody can hang with the idea of Frankie Edgar being, like, one of their buddies. You know what I mean? He's a really down-to-earth guy. He's that guy who, like, fought up in a weight class for a really long time.
And
for,
became
like, no
champion
reason.
Of that weight class.
Not only champion, but dethroned maybe the best 155-pounder in history.
And not even one time. He beat him twice.
And not twice barely. Twice handedly.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, like, that story in itself, nobody gave him any chance to beat BJ Penn. He beat him. It was like this historic moment. He's this like undersized guy. You just like want to get behind him.
Which is why I have to say, sorry to cut you off, is that so UFC 200 being a flagship show and the show they're trying to load up, you know, they say that 196, Dana White came out and said it did about 1.5 million buys, shade under what the Brock Lesnar, Frank Mir fight at UFC 100 did, which is really incredible. And they, of course, charge about $5 more per pay-per-view now. So it was the highest grossing pay-per-view of all time. But they want to load up 200 and try to break that 1.6 record. And I feel like it, as the flagship show, when that show goes off the air, the last image you see, they probably want it to be Conor McGregor holding his belt high, right?
I would imagine that that's what they want.
But if that's not what it is, how to your point, how awesome would it be if Frankie Edgar gets that huge win on maybe the biggest pay-per-view of all time? Because he's a guy that's been there since, I want to say he came into the UFC, and we could have the intern, the non-existent intern, double-check it, 2007, 2006-ish maybe? I mean, he's been around forever.
Yeah, well, and the other thing about that, too, is that, like, so there was that big storyline for a really long time about how, you know, Conor McGregor was going to be, you know, the, whatever, third two-division champion of all time.
Such clickbait bullshit.
Yeah, well, and it was a big deal, right? He's going to be the third two-division champion, first person to do it at the same time. Frankie Edgar would be the third two-division champion with that win.
I mean, which is How ironic is that?
Yeah, yeah, that it would be taking it off of Conor McGregor to become the third two-division champion.
And just to confirm, he did debut in the UFC February of 2007, fight of the night, decision win over Tyson Griffin. I mean, this guy, he goes back a ways, man.
Yeah, I mean, Tyson Griffin, nice throwback name there, too. Yeah, but I used to love that guy.
So we're going back about 10 years almost with Frankie Edgar.
And 10 quality years. I mean, I bet you if you and you've got it open now, you can flip through those. I bet you'd be hard-pressed to find a two-fight losing streak.
Well,
I mean, maybe one or two in there.
Yeah, that's the issue, is how the split decision loss to Benson Henderson.
Oh, God,
so
yeah.
That was his second loss in a row to Benson, and then he fought Jose for the featherweight title. So he does have a three-fight losing streak in there, but the split decision loss, very controversial.
If that was a win, he would not have a two-fight losing streak
correct.
In 10 years.
Right.
Like, insane. You know, like, that's unheard of at that level of the sport.
Yeah. So anyway, that was, maybe a preview of your main event coming from Dana White there saying the fans want to see Edgar. Then you also had Fariz Zahabi, coming out, and I don't know if it was an interview form or on Twitter, but he basically, insinuated that GSP would be keen to fight our guy, Nate Diaz.
Yeah. And you know what? We talked last week about finding a way to capitalize on Nate Diaz's newfound popularity. That's it.
That's it.
That's it right there. Because, you know, he can't fight for the title and have not, 800 people in line at the 170 division go horseshit. You know, like
Tyron Woodley was promised the shot.
Would be pissed.
Condit could be given a rematch after
Condit
that
could
great
be
fight.
Given a rematch. The winner of Wonderboy and
Rory
should have it. I mean, like, or GSP himself.
And even Damian Maia in the mix.
Oh, Damian Maia's on like a 5-fight win streak too. So right. Like, you have all of these great 170 contenders.
And then you're going to bypass them with Nate Diaz?
It would be a terrible choice. Nate shouldn't fight the 155 champ either. So like, but at, like I said, at the same time, throwing him to Eddie Alvarez or something like that would not do justice to the popularity boost. GSP is perfect for that. He's already got bad blood with the Diaz brothers. Nick can't fight him right now because he's suspended, so let Nate fight him for him.
I agree Brilliant. With everything you just said. I also have to say, though, I kind of came around the past week to the idea of, and you're probably going to hate this, we talked about it last week, and I agreed with you on this point then, but I've changed my mind now, and that's I'm down with Nate Diaz versus RDA, and I'll tell you why. He didn't come into that fight in December from 2 years ago, 2014, in shape or motivated. This is a different Nate Diaz 1 year later.
Yeah, okay, so I agree with that, but like at the same time, how many's Tony Ferguson won in a row?
Like seven, I believe.
Okay, and you're telling me Tony Ferguson goes out and beats Nurmagomedov, and we're just going to be like, yeah, Nate Diaz on a one-fight winning streak. Or two-fight winning streak.
Fight business, baby,
oh,
business.
No, but I hate that.
No, I'm
that,
with
I mean,
you.
Like,
yeah. Here's the thing, though. What sucks about the way this is lined up and 200 being in July is just that Tony Ferguson and Habib are going to have a war in April. I expect nothing less. I just don't see them being able to turn around in 2 months and then fight again.
Well, and maybe that's what's keeping Dana from booking Nate Diaz at all.
Right.
Because maybe he's like, well, if neither of those two can go and RDA's foot's all healed up, maybe I'll throw
Nate Diaz
and RDA
that.
Together. Yeah. But if one of them's healthy, I'll put Nate with GSP and I'll put the other one with the winner.
It's worth reminding everyone, we broke this down last week. There really are only about three title possibilities for UFC 200. You have the featherweight title, which has pretty much been confirmed. It will be defended. You have the lightweight title, a little bit up in the air. And then you have the, what was the third one, Gumby? The women's bantamweight, but they've already basically said they're going to wait for Rousey to come back. So unless they could convince her to come back before that November timeline she had previously outlined, it's featherweight, it's lightweight, and it's welterweight. I apologize. Yep. And welterweight, of course, Lawler will probably have a title defense there. And then I'll throw one more out at you. If Jon Jones got through the Cormier fight, we're both expecting him to win in April. If he got through with no medical suspension, if they wanted to do a quick turnaround Jon Jones and have him fight Rumble at 200?
Rumble or Gustafson? I mean, like, Gustafson's not booked, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
I mean, Rumble would work, too. Either of those would work for me.
I also feel like, I mean, not that their promises mean anything, but did they not say when Rumble just beat Bader that Rumble was now the...
Yeah, I mean, like, they say things.
Yeah.
I'd take either of those two. That would be a nice – I think it would have to be a co-main behind Connor. Yeah. But definitely a possibility there too.
Yeah. So that's kind of your UFC 200 outlook. Call it 100 and semi 18 semi days away or something.
I do want to throw in there too. Cowboy Cerrone tweeting out that if GSP needs somebody, he'll happily take that one.
Cowboy knows where the money's at.
I mean, yeah, exactly. Cowboy just being Cowboy. So that's a fun one to think about in the back of your head, too. Maybe if Nate gets pulled off for an RDA fight, maybe you see Cowboy step in there because Cowboy will fight anybody.
So I'll give you one other little bit of news I wanted to touch base with you on, and I was having a discussion with some MMA fan friends of mine about this. You know, Dana White came out and said Holly Holm's management was so stupid for taking this fight. She could have waited and it could have been the biggest fight ever against Ronda Rousey when Rousey was ready to return. And then I think Cal Sonnen came out on his podcast and said when you do the math, what Holly was probably staring at was a $10 million payday against Ronda. She has a $500,000 flat show or win. But with pay-per-view points, assuming Holly versus Ronda got, you know, maybe broke that 1.6 barrier record, got in the 1.8, maybe 2 million range, and if Holly was at, let's call it, no one knows what the pay-per-view points are. I think it's been rumored that GSP and Anderson Silva have been in the $4 per pay-per-view buy range. So let's just even put Holly there, $4 per pay-per-view buy at a 1.8 to 2 million buy rate. So maybe that's 8 million. And then whatever other bonuses and backroom stuff she has. So Chael was saying $10 million she walked away from. I don't find it that stupid that she wanted to fight. Here's why. One, we really don't know what's going on with Ronda. Like, she's out in Hollywood. She's not getting punched in the face. She might be making millions to just act being punched in the face. Who knows when she's coming back? Holly wanted to stay active. She's a warrior. She's a true martial artist. And she wanted to fight someone and defend her title. That pay-per-view on Saturday ended up making her a million anyway. She had a $500,000 to show her to win, and she had some form of pay-per-view points in there. Dana White said three people made millions on Saturday: Holly, Nate, and Connor.
You can come out and say it's dumb because she would have made 10 against Ronda or whatever, like that.
But that fight's still there.
She's got money fights left.
Fight's still there. So she made, let's just say it, conservatively, she made 1.2 million on Saturday, two Saturdays ago, and then she fights again and makes another million. Now she's at 2 million, and then the Ronda fight will be there someday, hopefully.
Can you imagine if she walked into that fight with Misha, 35 seconds into the fight, she throws a mean head kick, knocks Misha's head off, and walks off, you know, like one of those sweet walk-off
KOs. Her stock's even higher.
Oh, my God. Could you imagine the people who are ready to watch that the next fight? Everybody would be lining up. She'd have huge fan base. And, yeah, it didn't work out that way, but it's easy to, like, talk shit about her manager after it's already happened. Hindsight's 20/20.
That's Dana being Dana. And I'll also say, too, I think people really gained a lot of respect for Holly not tapping, and then to see Connor do the quick tap. I think the word, and I don't want to get into that discussion.
Oh, I hate the
whole, yeah. I'm with you on that.
You tap and see another day. That's my one sentence answer to that one.
But the point being, I think Holly gained a shit ton of street cred just from the performance itself, you know, and as did Misha. That was an awesome fight.
Yeah, it was an awesome fight. It makes that division so fun right now.
And one other thing I'll say about that, Gumby, I don't really know that Dana White should be going out talking bad about one of his fighters for taking a fight. Because I feel like, you know, Dana White's whole career is based on, do you want to be a fucking fighter?
Yeah, and she wanted to be a fucking fighter.
She wanted to be a fucking fighter. And then he's going to give Connor props for stepping up in two weight classes, but then give her shit for not holding back. You don't want to have a champion standing out of competition or hanging back from competition to save up for a money fight. Like, I know it is the fight business, as we just said, but you want your champions defending their titles.
Yeah.
That's what the sport's based on.
Yeah. Weird double talk, but like, I mean, like, nothing new from Dana White though, right?
Totally,
like,
true.
Exactly what you expect.
All right. We will turn our attention now to UFC Fight Night Brisbane this upcoming Saturday, March 19th. It is headlined by Frank Mir versus Super Samoan Mark Hunt. Mark Hunt is coming off a win over Bigfoot Silva back in November. He knocked out Bigfoot Silva in the first round. That was in Australia at the Rousey Home pay-per-view. Ever heard of it? Nothing happened. Don't need to see it. And he will be fighting Frank Mir, who's coming off the unanimous decision loss to Andre Arlovsky. These are two veterans of the heavyweight division, two legends of the UFC. How do you see this one going down, Gumby?
Heavyweight division, I say it pretty much every single time I break down a heavyweight fight. So hard to predict. I mean, like, the smart money would be on Hunt at home, right? Hunt's got crazy knockout power. Mir's boxing's gotten a little better, but, it's still not his go-to. You would expect Mark Hunt to get the knockout here, but I will say, Mir went out last time, looked completely out of shape, looked overweight and stuff like that. If he changes that around and he comes in shape, I mean, if he gets Hunt down, I don't like Hunt's chances on the ground at all.
Oh, I have a new segment I want to debut on this show that I didn't even talk to you about.
Okay, yeah, go for it.
We're going to debut it right now. It is called Stat of the Week. Stat of the Week. Gumby, actually, it's going to be Stat of the Week and Trivia of the Week, okay. But it's 2-in-1, as brought to you by Fightmetric. Not a sponsor, but just somewhere we frequent. In Frank Mir's last 8 fights, Gumby, how many takedowns has he scored in those 8 fights?
Ooh, ha. Do I get, some kind of range? Can I get, within 2 and I get the points?
Yeah, we'll give you a within 2.
A 2-point buffer. I'm going to say this is lower than people would expect. In his last 8 fights, I will say he's gotten 6 takedowns.
Okay, you are wrong. That's even with the +2 handicap. In Frank Mir's last 8 fights, he's gotten 3 takedowns.
Oof.
Not since facing Roy Nelson when he got 6 takedowns. And even going back further than that, I mean, he has not had a fight with multiple takedowns in it till Dan Christensen, his UFC comeback fight. No, actually, yeah, in 2006.
Okay,
it was right after the motorcycle accident.
But the problem with that, though, too, is that for a while he had gotten away from his takedown. So, the reason I guess low, or at least I thought I was guessing low, was, for a while, the Duffy fight, he didn't obviously attempt a takedown, but a couple other ones in there, he thought he could box everybody. And that's why he went on that 4-fight losing streak against Arlovsky, even though it didn't work, he was trying to wrestle him up. He was trying to get him down. He was trying to turn it into a grappling match, pin him against the cage, rip him down, which to me signals that he's going back to the smart money way for him to fight is with his takedowns. And I think Arlovsky's takedown defense is head and shoulders better than Hunt. If I had to bet on this one, I would still take Hunt.
That's what I was going to say.
I would still take Hunt in this one because you know what? Hunt throws just as hard as he does in round 5 as he does in round 1. And every single time he lands that uppercut, it's lights out. He's got hooks that'll knock you out. He's got everything that could knock you out.
68% takedown defense from Mark Hunt as well.
Yeah, which is, it's decent. But, when have you seen him be super, super effective against a really, really large guy and takedown defense? I wouldn't say that I've seen that too much. So I like Hunt in the end here, but I would say cautiously I like Hunt. What's the odds on that?
So you have Mir in most sports books hovering around a +150 dog with Hunt at about a, let's call it, average it out to a -170 favorite.
Okay, so yeah, I would say that's about right. I expected him to be a little bit larger of a favorite, but I would still play cautiously if I was betting on that one.
Fair. We'll move to the co-main event, which is Hector Lombard coming off a juicing suspension. He will be fighting Neil Magny, who is coming off a win over Kevin Gastelum by split decision in the main event of a fight night back in November. He's 2-1 is Neil Magny in his last 3, the one loss coming to Damian Maia by submission, which halted, I want to say, a 6 or 7 fight win streak at the time for Magny. On the other hand, you have Lombard, who's coming off the no contest because he popped, which was a win overturned against Josh Berkman. He is 2-1 in his 3 fights before the overturned contest. He beat Jake Shields. He beat Nate Marquardt by KO. He lost to Yushin Okami by split decision. How do you see this one playing out, my man?
So I liked Lombard's skills before the suspension. So let me preface that. His judo is solid.
Sick judo.
He's got really good stuff. But a lot of times, those takedowns that he needs are supplemented by the fact that he is extremely strong and extremely fit for 170. You got to imagine he's going to come in significantly smaller than he was before. And to me, with a little bit less power on his judo, his game is just like Kelvin Gastelum's. You know what I mean? Needs to get you down in order to win. Not going to beat you on his feet very often. I mean, obviously you said he knocked out Marquardt, but not going to beat you on his feet all that often. Magny keeps him on his feet, or Magny winds up on top with a less muscly Lombard. So, I mean, obviously I'm playing the game here that I assume he's going to come in smaller and not roided up. But I think this is a good fight for Magny, and it's a nice name to have under his belt if he does win.
And Lombard is the, call it about plus 120 dog in this, and Magny the minus 140 favorite. So,
so right around that line, right about a pick'em. But,
yeah, you know, for me, I guess Magny, you know, I think he's not as good as that 6 or 7 fight win streak indicated, but he's not as bad as we saw when Damian Maia just strangled the life out of him.
But Damian Maia will make anybody look bad. Exactly. I mean, he made Gunnar Nelson look bad, for Christ's sake.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So, you know, I think there is some life left in the Magny train. Do I think he is a future champion at 170? No, I do not.
I can't see him in with somebody like Wonder Boy.
No, absolutely
not. But I think he coasts on Lombard here, and especially a skinnier Lombard.
He's a gamer, and it'll just be interesting to see what Lombard do we get. So that'll be something to watch out for. Now, we move on to what I believe to be the funnest fight on the card and the fight that I am most looking forward to, because it is a matchup of two surging prospects. You have Jake Matthews, the Celtic kid from Australia himself, going against Hollywood Johnny Case. Johnny Case is on a 4-fight win streak. That includes a knockout over Frankie Perez and a submission over Kazuki Tokodomo. And Jake Matthews, also once a very highly touted prospect, 2-1 in his last 3, 3-1 overall in the UFC, only blemish in the UFC, a guillotine, got caught in a guillotine and lost to James Vick in the first round while shooting a takedown. Gumby, your thoughts?
See, and I thought he looked good on the feet there, too, until he took that takedown. I personally am a big fan of Jake Matthews. He's super, super young. I think he's like 21, maybe 22 years old. Young kid, lots of talent.
21 years old, yeah, is confirmed.
21 years old. So, yeah, he's a really young guy. He was on one of those tough smashes seasons, and he didn't look so good in the house, but I think when he's out and has a full camp, he's a killer, and he's going to be a fun one to watch. Case is on a win streak, but there's been a time or two in there where I didn't find Case all that impressive, and I think that Matthews' grappling here is going to be the difference. You know, as long as he stays away from getting himself submitted in like a silly way like he did against Vic, I think his top game is good enough to hold Case down and see some grounded pound. And if he doesn't win, he'll at least tire Case out early so that he can coast to the decision win instead of getting the stoppage.
And it's just worth noting, if you want to go to the nerd stats, Jake Matthews, 100% takedown defense to Johnny Case, 68% takedown defense.
You're not taking Matthews down unless you're a pretty stellar grappler.
Matthews averaging about 3 takedowns per 15-minute fight. Johnny Case, 2.43 takedowns. Striking, strikes landed per minute, Jake Matthews, 4.34 per fight or per minute, and Johnny Case, 3.76.
Even a better output for Matthews.
Correct.
Yeah, which not surprising. He's super, super aggressive. You get that with the younger kids most of the time.
Both orthodox, both a 72-inch reach, but you are giving the nod here to Jake Matthews.
Absolutely. I love the kid. He's awesome to watch.
Vegas has it. Oh, razor thin, Gumby. Razor thin. Minus 105 for Jake Matthews, the favorite. And actually, they're both favorited. And Johnny Case, minus 115.
So technically, Case is the favorite because he's a deeper minus. But both of them, you're putting in more than you're getting out on those betting odds.
Yeah, this is really hot prospect versus hot prospect. So one of the more exciting fights we've had here in the past month when it comes to young talent. All right, we will move on in the card. You have at middleweight, we have Daniel Kelly, the Australian native himself, going up against Antonio Carlos Jr. out of Coconut Creek, Florida. Daniel Kelly is 3-1 overall in the UFC, 2-1 in his last 3, his one loss being to Smiling Sam Alvey, our friend of the show, KO in the first round. Antonio Carlos Jr. coming off a no contest against Kevin Casey. He could not continue from the first round. Do you remember that fight? What happened there?
Don't remember that off the top of my head. It's a no contest?
Yeah, could not continue.
Could it have possibly been because, but it's a no contest, I think, maybe because Was that the one where Casey popped for steroids? Casey recently popped for steroids, right?
Yeah, that might have been the Casey.
So maybe it was a TKO originally for Casey. I can't remember, to be honest with you.
Well, going back further than that, 2-1, he beat Eddie Gordon via submission. He lost to Patrick Cummins by unanimous decision, and he beat Vitor Miranda via unanimous decision. He was on Team Vanderlei at Tough Brazil 3. What do you know about him, and what do you think?
I love his hands. All kinds of power in those hands. I mean, he beat Vitor Miranda, who I talked very nicely about, who fought recently. And I think this guy's got a style, maybe not exactly like Sam Alvey, but very similar to Sam Alvey, which obviously just spells trouble for Kelly. I mean, like, he's walking in against a guy who fights a ton like a guy who's already knocked him out. And, you know, he's shown that he's got a chin that doesn't hold up all the time under big power shots. You know, I'd expect him to throw, a decent power shot here, too, and get the KO. I'm going to say early.
Wow. You like it that much?
I like him that much, yeah. I think Antonio Carlos Jr. is a hell of a prospect.
All right, so the non-existent intern looked up, did some fact-checking, and it was the eye poke at the Nama Yunus Van Zandt fight night card,
Yes.
11 seconds into the bout.
Yep.
Junior accidentally poked Casey in the eye, and
it ended right away.
It ended right away. So there you go. But you are going with Antonio Carlos Jr.
Yep.
here. Bet the farm.
Yeah, I would say bet heavy. And I would imagine the odds are not going to pay you all that well.
That is correct. He's about a -500 favorite to Daniel Kelly, +425.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
All right, moving on in the card, we have at middleweight again, James Tahuna, another Australian native, going up against Stephen Bose. Did I say that right?
Yeah, I think it's Bose. He's the one who was when Rampage couldn't fight Maldonado, but then could fight Maldonado. You remember that? He got dropped out of the fight because he was in a lawsuit with Bellator. And then they were like, oh, this Stephen Bose guy got hired to fight Maldonado. And then Rampage came back and could take the fight. And then Bose was just like randomly on their roster.
Right. And then so he only has one fight in the UFC, which was then they pushed him back to June. This was the fight card where Lyoto Machida got his ass handed to him by PED Yoel Romero.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, Stephen Bose lost to Thiago Santos via KO in the first round. He will be fighting James Tahuna, who is on a 3-fight losing streak. To some names, if you want to, you know, have a silver lining to it, he lost to Nate Marquardt, which wasn't the worst of it, but he lost to Mauricio Shogunhua and Glover Teixeira. What are your thoughts on this fight, and is James Tahuna going to be kicked out of the UFC with his 4th loss in a row?
He's definitely fighting for his job here. I mean, like, the only reason they'll give him this fight, they had a card coming up in Australia, and he's a fun fighter to watch. I mean, he's got a lot of chops. He's not particularly great in any area, but I can imagine that he wants to box Bose here. And I mean, I think almost he's getting one here because I don't think Bose's all that good on his feet. He's a little bit better elsewhere, like up against the cage and stuff like that. But I think more or less they're trying to feed Tahuna a win here. And Bose's in the UFC because he was willing to take a late notice fight against Maldonado. Maldonado is not a guy you want to take a late notice fight against. And that's even the fact that he's been let go from the UFC. I still wouldn't take a late notice fight with him because that guy hits so hard and you can't knock him out. So, I mean, I would say Tahuna, I'd say he outworks him just on the feet constantly, dictates where the fight goes.
And in Vegas, Tahuna is about a -240 favorite. Bose, you could get about +205, as much as +215 if you want to bet on the dog. All right, so moving on, we will move to the women's strawweight offering on the main card, and that is Beck Rollins, an Australian native herself, fighting, and I'm going to butcher this name, Sohee Ham.
Sohee Ham?
Sohee Ham.
I think it's Sohee Ham is how you say it.
Sohee Ham is 1-1 in the UFC. She lost to Joanne Calderwood via unanimous decision, but then came back and beat Courtney Case via unanimous decision. Beck Rawlings, you might know her from The Ultimate Fighter. She is 1-1 in the UFC, lost to Heather Clark at the Ultimate Fighter 20 finale via unanimous decision, came back and beat Lisa Ellis via first round sub. What are your thoughts on Rowdy Beck Rollins versus Siohi Ham?
So Rowdy Beck Rollins is just a gritty veteran. She seems like she's been around forever. Even though her record isn't as deep as it is, she's got that style where she'll put you up against the cage and grind you out. And I think that's what she did to Lisa Ellis. But Heather Jo Clark worked her on her feet, you know, and tagged her a whole bunch. And I don't know if anybody saw that Siohi Ham fight when she fought Joanne Calderwood, but Calderwood, who is stellar on her feet, she's got great Muay Thai.
Yeah.
Siohi Ham tagged her a bunch of times. You know, Siohi Ham was getting the best of her, and in some people's mind may have even beat Calderwood. Because I remember when the judges were going to the scorecards, and I was like, man, I don't know which way this went. And I was hoping for Calderwood, but I was a little bit nervous because I thought Ham might have gotten it. I think if Rawlings can't get her up against the cage, this is a Ham's fight all day. And it's probably, let me guess, underdog pick for Ham.
It is, but it's actually very slight. Ham is the minus 125 dog, and Rawlings only a plus 105.
Wait, Rawlings is the dog?
Or sorry, yes, I'm dyslexic. Plus 105, Beck Rawlings is the dog, and Siohi Ham is the favorite at minus 125.
I'm a little bit surprised by that because people seem to like Rawlings so much, I thought it would maybe skew the line a little bit.
I mean, maybe some horny guys late at night on Twitter like Beck Rawlings so much, but matchmakers seem to have saw what you saw in Siohi Ham's previous fights.
I think so, too. I think she's a fun striker. I think she's got to shore up the parts of her game, like getting off the cage and making sure that she's staying on her feet. But apart from that, I think she's definitely better than Rollins.
All right. So who's your final pick?
I'm going to go with Ham by decision. You know, not enough power there to knock her out, especially because Rollins is so gritty. But I'd say she probably outworks her for a couple of rounds. Maybe Rollins steals one.
All right. Well, that wraps up the main card. We are going to cut to our interview with Drew Dober. And at the other side of that, we will break down the undercard and the rest of the fight card, including the Fight Pass prelims. This interview with Drew Dober, however, is brought to you by New England Submission Fighting. New England Submission Fighting, a mixed martial arts gym in the lovely and quaint college town of Amherst, Massachusetts. Don't let the town fool you, though. It is city quality MMA training, 6 nights a week, no gi, submission grappling, whatever your preference to call it is the gym's specialty. But there's also great stand-up striking classes on Tuesday and Wednesday nights with Coach Kirik Janess, a veritable legend in the MMA community. Gumby, I train there. You train there. What are your thoughts on New England Submission
Fighting? I'd never train anywhere else, to tell you the truth. You know, I trained a couple of places when I was first starting to try to find a place for jiu-jitsu. There's no place where you get the attention like you do at NESF. There's no place where you get to try out and figure out what you do best and have stuff tailored around what you do best so that you can become as good as you possibly can. You know, they're not trying to force you into this system at all. They're trying to make you as good as you could possibly be, and I think they do just that.
I mean, I started my training out in Los Angeles. I've trained all over New York City. I was just there this past weekend, had the pleasure of going to Marcelo Garcia's. And for, you know, a smaller type gym that doesn't have the student enrollment that a big city gym does, the quality of instruction at NESF is bar none. Knee bar none. Okay, bad pun. Anyway, New England Submission Fighting presents you our interview with Drew Dober.
This is Daniel Gumby Vreeland here with Top Turtle MMA and my co-host Dave Tremonti. We are here talking with Drew Dober, who fights April 16th against Islam Makhachev at UFC Fox 19. So we're going to get right into it here, Drew. You came off a big win off of Scott Holtzman recently. You seem to change around your game plan a little bit. It looked like you were taking the game to him with a little bit of wrestling. What can we attribute to that new game plan?
Well, you know, since moving out to Denver, Colorado, and training with the Monsters at Team Elevation, I have increased all aspects of the game, jiu-jitsu, wrestling, and striking. And so, you know, I think one way is to come in with a game plan, but if you're too set on one game plan, things don't go your way. Then people are just less flexible. So I came in with a little less of a game plan and was able to, improv. And so I saw a takedown that was available to me, and so I just kept after it.
Part of the big stuff out of Team Elevation and the Muscle Farm facilities right now is that, there's the big beef between
TJ Dillashaw and Uriah Faber. Is that something that you ever get out of TJ, or is that something that that tends to get brought up, or is that more fabricated from the media?
You know, Conor McGregor was able to amplify it more than it should have been. Fighters, you know, not gym bounce, but fighters tend to be very nomadic. You know, we go where the food's at. And so when, you know, one gym is no longer serving a purpose, we you know, move to a different one. And so it's not a topic that's being brought up too much. However, I do see quite a bit on TJ's Instagram where incredibly shallow and uneducated people keep posting snake images or e-coms on his Instagram comments.
TJ Snake-a-Shaw, I think, is what the kids on Twitter keep saying.
Well, you know, we have a bunch of, you know, keyboard warriors and trolls, and, you know, they, you know, it's, you know, hate them and love them at the same time because they're the ones that follow you and give you the social media recognition.
Now, one of your teammates, Matt Brown, is getting ready to fight Jiu-Jitsu Machine Damian Maia. Are you helping him train for that fight at all?
Matt Brown, you know, I actually just recently found out that he was scheduled to fight Damian Maia. And so me personally, no, I have not been a significant training partner for him. But I am currently playing the mock Hector Lombard for Neil Magny's bout in USA Brisbane.
So that's interesting. So what is it like trying to mirror, you know, he's kind of got like a more of a stalking approach, and he's got that heavy judo background. What is it like trying to mimic, you know, one of the biggest guys down there at 170?
Well, I probably don't have the biceps or the shoulders of Hector Lombard, but I am a 5'8" southpaw that I'm able to stalk Neil Magny to the best of my ability. Obviously, I'm nowhere near at the Olympic level judo, but I think in the striking department, I'm able to simulate as best I can. But, you know, I am one of many of the training partners that Neil Magny has that, you know, one of many that he just hands us our own ass.
Let's talk a little bit about your matchup because you're fighting on April 16th. So you're fighting a sambo fighter, which is, you know, a style that's up and coming in MMA right now. You're seeing more and more of it in the UFC. How has it been trying to find somebody who mimics the style of a guy who's so into combat sambo and has such a good combat sambo background?
Well, combat sambo, I mean, I personally have known it for quite some time. I was actually a big fan of Art Stador and the Emelianenko brother. And so, yeah, I did my research on sambo and found out it's really just like, you know, heavy judo followed with some heavy jiu-jitsu. And so where judo ends as soon as you hit the ground and jiu-jitsu starts when it hits the ground, sambo is like a beautiful blend of both. And so, yeah, I'm perfectly aware of it. I've seen his videos. I'm impressed with, you know, what he accomplished, you know, what he has accomplished. But I think I'm very prepared. I'm going to be even more prepared, and I'm extremely ready to counter what he has to offer.
You've had kind of a mixed reaction in the UFC. You had a big win over Jamie Varner. But you also had that weird stoppage against Silva down in Brazil that actually got overturned as a no contest. Do you find that MMA has like an issue with refs who know what's going on, or is that like a completely isolated incident for you?
You know, I think it's a very isolated incident. You know, it's mixed feelings about being a part of that, but I don't think that kind of thing is going to happen often. Yeah, I view it as a very unique situation.
Did that ref come up to you after the fight and apologize?
No, not at all. We spoke, you know, that's the thing, we only really spoke before the bout, you know, when the referee comes in the locker room and gives us the rules. And I significantly remember him telling me in an individual situation that if I need to tap, make sure that he notices the tap significantly because he's going to let the fight go on if he doesn't see anything significant. Well, then, you know, the fight happens and there's absolutely nothing significant and he stops the bout. And then after the fight, I was so confused, so frustrated, so flustered that, no, I had no words to say to him.
So that's some really bizarre stuff. And obviously, I'm sure the appeals process was not easy either, correct?
Yeah. Well, I mean, UFC did a tremendous job of, you know, having my back and best representing me. And so I have to thank the UFC, Dana White, and all those guys that were able to, you know, also put work in to get it overturned.
Well, Drew, we cannot thank you enough for the time. It's been great talking to you. I do have one last question. At 195, you walked out to Ain't No Other Man by Christina Aguilera. You won the fight. Can we expect more Christina Aguilera?
Maybe Christina Aguilera, or maybe some Color Me Bad, Michael Jackson,
oh,
who knows?
Nice. Yeah, take it old school. Okay, keep us guessing.
Exactly. You know, I don't like being set on the one song. I like surprising people and, you know, making a joke out of the entrance.
All right. We respect the heck out of it. So we will look forward to that in your next fight, seeing what you pick as a new walkout song. Drew, we cannot thank you enough for the time. We wish you luck in your next fight, and thanks for chatting.
Thank you so much.
So there you have it, Gumby, Drew Dober.
Yeah, he's, you know, a guy not a terrible lot of people have seen fight because he's been on the undercard. But he's a wicked fun guy to talk to, and, you know, he's got some good wins on that record, including one over Jamie Varner.
And as we discussed, he's training with a very good fight team.
Yeah, getting some of the best training right there.
All right, so we will move on to the rest of Fight Night Brisbane. We will bring you our breakdown and preview of the undercard, starting with a welterweight bout, Brendan O'Reilly, an Australian native, fighting the model, Alan Joban. That is my nickname for him because he is a male model. So I always think of the model Rick Martel, the professional wrestler from the early 1990s. Joban coming off a tough loss against Albert Tumenov, who's just a killer in his own right. It was a knockout in the first round. 2-1, though, in his last three. He had a win over Matt Dwyer and a win over Richard Walsh previous to the Tumenov loss. Brendan O'Reilly on the other side, Gumby, is coming off a win over Vic Grujic, a unanimous decision win. But before that, he lost to Liping Zhang via unanimous decision. So Brendan O'Reilly, 1-1 in the UFC. Your thoughts?
I'd like Alan Joban. I mean, I like Alan Joban in a lot of fights. I mean, I even had him beating Tumenov. Tumenov's just a crazy good striker.
Killer.
You can't fault him for losing to Tumenov. I mean, Tumenov's in a conversation for the top guys in that division. You know, and Joban, you know, who knows? He doesn't get tagged like that. That fight goes on longer. He's got a great gas tank.
He's a gamer. And he's good off his back. Eddie Bravo guy, I think he trains out.
Yeah,
with 10th Planet.
He trains some 10th Planet. So, you know, I mean, good off his back, probably won't ever need to go there because he's just going to tag O'Reilly on his feet hard.
Vegas sees it much the same. Joban, a minus 475 favorite to Brendan O'Reilly, the plus 380 dog. No reason to pick against Vegas here.
Correct? I don't think so.
Alrighty, Rue. We will move on then, unless you have anything else to say about that, which I don't think you do. It's a featherweight bout. Dan Hooker out of Auckland, New Zealand, fighting Mark Adiva from the Philippines. Mark Adiva is 1-2 in his last three, his only three fights in the UFC. He's coming off a split decision loss to Levan Makhchveli. And Dan Hooker is coming off a loss to Uber prospect Yair Rodriguez via unanimous decision. He is 2-2 overall in the UFC with wins over Hatsu Hioki and Ian Entswistle. Your thoughts?
I like Hooker. Hooker is a weird kind of fighter. He's super, super long. And if you remember that fight against Hioki, crazy head kick knockout. And Hatsu Hioki was highly touted for a while. Adiva, I mean, he kind of got out-wrestled by Makhchveli, but so does everybody when they fight him. Makhchveli just out-wrestled Damon Jackson and would have won if he didn't get a point deduction in there. So, I mean, I think Hooker by knockout, Hooker's knockout skills are pretty high for a guy who doesn't look very physically intimidating.
Hooker, the minus 200 favorite. Adiva, a plus 170 dog. You are going all Hooker all night.
Those are your words, not mine.
Correct. We move on to a women's bantamweight offering. We have Leslie Smith fighting Rin Nakai. Rin Nakai, you may remember as being the... she made her debut against Misha Tate in UFC Japan. It was headlined by Hunt versus Nelson. You know, local fighter out of Japan. The world might know her from some really weird internet videos. You could look it up at your own...
I was
own,
waiting for you to mention something
Your
like
own
that.
Discretion, Rin Nakai. But she lost to Misha Tate, part of the war path Misha Tate went on after losing to Rousey in that title fight from 2 years back. Nakai will be coming back now after about a year and a half off to fight Leslie Smith, who is 1-2 in the UFC, coming off a loss to Jessica I. Gumby, break it down.
So Nakai, despite all joking aside, she is like a really legitimate grappler. I mean, she's very, very strong and very, very big for 135 pounds. She's short and she's built like a wrestler. And I think you're going to see her trying to wrestle Leslie Smith here. Whether or not her gas tank holds up like it didn't against Miesha Tate could be the story here, but I think it does, and I'm going to take Nakai.
All right, Nakai, the plus 150 dog to Leslie Smith, the minus 170 favorite, but you like her as the
dog.
Yeah,
I like her as a dog, and you know what? Just like heavyweight, in the women's bantamweight division, you almost, you know, it's worth playing dogs sometimes just because it's so unpredictable.
All right, we will move on to a welterweight offering. We have Rick Walsh, the New South Wales native, Sydney, New South Wales, that is. He will be fighting Viscardi Andrade, a product de Brazil. Andrade is coming off a win over Gassan Umalatov, a unanimous decision win at Belfort versus Henderson fight night back in November. He's 2-1 in the UFC overall. He had a KO win over Bristol Marande. Rick Walsh, on the other side of the fence, is 2-2 in the UFC. He has a loss to Alan Joban, previously mentioned in this discussion, but wins over Chris Indich and Steve Kennedy, both by decision. Your thoughts, Gumby?
Kind of an interesting little matchup. Both really, really gritty guys, and I know I just kind of seems like I throw that word out a lot. But Richard Walsh, you know, likes to go in. He likes to bang. He likes to grind people out. And, you know, I bet you he's an underdog in this one, but
it's just like another weird one where it's -110.
Like pick him again?
Yeah, it's -110 Richard Walsh. Andrade also -110, as much as -115.
So I expected Andrade to be a little bit more of a favorite because of his past wins. But, you know, Walsh, definitely a gamer, and I like Walsh in this one. I'll take him by unanimous decision.
I'm not going to fight you on it. You move on then, and now we're out of the FS1 prelims and into the Fight Pass prelims, if I'm not mistaken, and we have Ross Pearson. There's a name everyone knows and loves, fighting Chad Laprese out of Montreal, Quebec, Canada. Pearson, of course, the Brit. Ross Pearson is 1-2 in his last three fights, coming off a tough decision loss to Francisco Trinaldo. Did have a nice win over Paul Felder last year as well, though. And Laprese is coming off a loss also to Francisco Trinaldo. First round KO, he went down. But he has a win over Brian Barberina, who you might know as the Sage Slayer, and also was riding a three-fight win streak before that. He's 3-1 in the UFC overall. What do you think?
This is a weird fight for me because, you know, I'd been gearing up for Trujillo versus Ross Pearson, and Trujillo had a little bit of problems getting his visa to be able to fight in Australia. Laprise? So I think he was the second best fighter to come off of a season of The Ultimate Fighter in which he won. OAM, Olivier Albin Mercier, was the one I really liked off that show. But he was able to grind out Mercier, who's a good grappler. He doesn't want to be on his feet with Ross Pearson. But Ross Pearson's takedown defense has looked a little shaky in the past. I mean, that's why he lost to Trinaldo. So, I mean, if he isn't gotten much better at the takedown, I think this is Laprise's fight.
He is the -140 favorite. Pearson, a +100 dog.
Yeah, that's a little bit surprising because I know how much the books sometimes like Pearson because of his style.
And also the name fighter between the two as well.
He's a much bigger name than Laprise.
All right, and then we will wrap this all up, Gumby, with a fight that was just added. You have Alan Patrick Silva Alves versus Damian Brown. I dare you to tell me something about them.
So I like Alan Patrick. Alan Patrick's a big, big, strong guy for that weight class. He's very, very heavy. There's a reason they had him in originally with Laprise. It's because he could give a Laprise a run. I think his style is worse for Laprise than Ross Pearson's is. So I thought that was going to be a tougher matchup for Laprise. So I like Alan Patrick from the get-go. I did a little bit of background check on Damian Brown. He did lose 4 out of 5 at one point. could have been 5 out of 6 even at one point, if I remember correctly. But he's won 4 or 5 in a row since then. But even just a quick look at the records of his opponents, one guy's like 1-3. One guy made his MMA debut and never fought again in that win streak.
He did lose out of he did lose five out of six.
But
then reeled off 5 wins in a row to get this fight in the
UFC.
That,
but that 5 wins in a row, like I said, includes a win over a guy who's 1-3 and a win over a guy who's 0-1 in pro MMA. There's another one over a guy who's like 5-3 in there. You know, like, I don't want to say he was getting canned fights, but he was off of five losses in 6 fights. You do get some lesser competition when you've lost 5 out of 6. So he's gotten lesser competition for a while. It's kind of built his record back up. They needed a last-second replacement. I don't know too much about his style, but Alan Patrick, like I said, would have been a tough fight for Laprise. It's tough to pick up against Patrick knowing how good he is like that.
And it is worth noting, of course, Patrick is 2-1 in the UFC, his one loss coming to Mirbek Tuzumenov, a monster in his own right, which was a head kick and punches. They stopped the fight. That was back in June of last year. So it'll be interesting to see how he bounces back from that very brutal loss.
Absolutely.
All right. And that really does it. Oh, also worth noting that Laprise, that Alan Patrick is the -280 favorite. Damian Brown, only a +200 dog, which is actually rather surprising for a short notice first fight in the UFC. But it is what it is. So that takes care of the undercard. And if there's nothing else you want to say, Gumby, I think now is time to cut to our interview with Court McGee.
Yeah, and this is a little bit different tone on an interview here. If you're used to, you know, if you come to our show looking for MMA breakdowns, fight camp stuff, this is not that kind of interview. This is more of a little behind the scenes and what goes on in his life and the inspiring message he brings if you know any of his background.
Well said. So we will cut to that interview right now with Court McGee.
This is Daniel Gumby Vreeland here with Top Turtle MMA and my co-host David Tremonti. We are here with Court the Crusher McGee, who faces off against Santiago Ponzinibbio April 16th at UFC on Fox 19. Court, we're going to get right into it. We talked to Steven Seeler last week, who told us a little bit about his training. He said that you guys were currently looking for a new gym because there's been some troubles at the pit. Could you explain that a little bit to us?
It's changed names, so I moved to Utah County or Orem, Utah, for the gym facility. I quit my job like October 26, 2007, to pursue a career in mixed martial arts. I had a little boy on the way and getting married, and I kind of like was at that point where I was making the same amount of money plumbing as I was fighting. I kind of moved the whole family about 70 miles, you know, south of where I was at, and started teaching classes, and I worked 20 hours at the gym, and then I trained full-time there and started my thing off, you know, about 8 years ago. So that gym was a throwdown, and then it changed to the Academy, and then the Riven Academy, and then this, and then that. Had different ownership, and I think there was a lot of different things and a lot of trial and error, and it just didn't work out, so it ended up shutting down.
Just quickly to talk about one more of your biggest steps along the way. I mean, you were on The Ultimate Fighter. You won The Ultimate Fighter, having lost a fight on the show, which is you're the first and most impressive person to do that. Do you ever keep in touch with the guys from The Ultimate Fighter, train with any of them?
Yeah.
Or, I mean, Chuck Liddell being your coach and having ties to John Hackelman, do you still keep in touch with Chuck?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, from my overdose date to 5 years later, I won The Ultimate Fighter, dedicated my fight to all those who were struggling. But in that, I met a coach and I met a group of people. You know, John has said it on multiple occasions. I guess him and Chuck and Howard Davis, who's since passed away, the 1976 Olympic gold medalist, one of the best amateur boxers ever to walk the face of the planet. He was one of the coaches, Scott Epstein, who I sent a video of me training last night to. Jake Shields was one of the coaches on there who's been a training partner for quite a few of my training camps. He's a close friend of mine. And it's like I've kept in touch with not only the coaches, but, you know, quite a few of the guys from the show, including Chris McRae, the guy I fought in the finale. But, you know, I do keep in touch with them. Chuck cornered me for my last fight. He showed up like 5 minutes before and he said, "I'm walking out with you." And I'm like, "All right, dude."
That's awesome.
And so, you can do whatever you want when you're Chuck Liddell.
Yeah, except for they made him change his shoes. He had Nikes on, and they were like, you need Reeboks. And he's like, go find me some Reeboks then. This dude appeared out of nowhere, threw some Reeboks on him, and then we went out. But, yeah, I'm, you know, I consider them a family. John is more than just a coach. Rob is more than just a coach. They care about me inside and outside of competition. They care about what's going on in my life. Because, you know, a professional athlete, you know, you're fighting – career is not everything. That 15 minutes of fame, like what people see on interviews and what they, you know, interview, you can get a little bit more in depth. Face to face, you can get in a lot more depth. But what you see on television is not always what you see. But I've tried to put that. I, you know, somebody showed me that. Hey, listen, like this is what you're going to be known as. So make sure you carry yourself the way you want to be seen. And you know. Thank God I had a bunch of recovering addicts help steer me in the right direction. Because what you see is what you get. But I have coaches that care about me, you know, and I have teammates that care about me, and they've kind of carried me through the ups and downs of a professional career in the UFC.
And that's awesome. And, you know, it's something you've mentioned a couple of times here. You know, you've had the struggles with addiction in the past. You've obviously, you know, turned your life around. And I believe you're doing some motivational speaking to kids now, right, on your experiences. And
not just kids. As a matter of fact, this year, like since January 1, I've spoke 12 times, man.
That's awesome. And you're doing that to various addiction groups, or who are you speaking to exactly?
Oh, well, okay. So this is funny. I've been asked this on a few different occasions, but how many people who are listening to this know somebody who's struggling with substance abuse, alcoholism, drug addiction?
I would have to guess and everyone.
Exactly. And you have one or two that says no, but that's because their eyes aren't open. So, okay. So that's my demographic. So I'm a person in long-term recovery. See, there's a lot of stigma surrounding addiction. I say I'm a drug addict. They think I'm slamming dope, stealing stuff out of their garage. If I'm an alcoholic, I'm the guy panhandling, holding a sign up, you know, give me some money for some beer. And it's like, that's not me. I'm a neighbor. I'm a dad. You know, I'm a son. I'm a brother. I'm a friend. I'm all those things, but I wasn't when I was drinking and using. So I'm one of those people that made it out, and there's about 30 million of us in long-term recovery. And for me, about 90% of those started in their teenage years. So it's important to me to go out and share my experience, because I was a good student. I was a good kid. I had a good upbringing, middle working class. The effect produced by the marijuana, the alcohol, and the pain pills I tried was so elusive that I could not stop, even though, you know, it took everything from me. And see, I wanted to change myself on a Friday and Saturday night. I wanted to fit in. I didn't really fit in one specific group. I was in that stage in the teenage years where you don't know where you fit in or what you're supposed to be doing. And, you know, the group that I found myself with were drinking and partying. And when I drank, you know, it was like I had this sense of freedom. It was kind of like, oh, I can be who I am, you know, but I only found that through drinking. And then I started, you know, leading that double life. I knew I was a pretty good student, and I knew I was an athlete. And I liked the effects from getting good grades it had on my parents, you know, but now it was kind of like, you know, I had that freedom with the drinking and using. And see, at 15 years old, I didn't know that 6 years later it would take everything from me and leave me homeless and strung out on heroin. So I'm one of those kids that didn't think it was going to happen to me. So it's important for me to carry that message. But also too, from getting sober to 5 years later, winning the Ultimate Fighter, it's kind of like I can use that as an inspiration, because I'm a normal everyday guy from Layton, Utah. I mean, there's nothing special. I'm not a world champion in anything. I'm not overly intelligent. I'm a normal everyday kid. And I can tell you where it took me when I started to drink and use. And so, you know, I just carry a message of hope to people who struggle, and family members and friends who struggle with substance abuse. And I got asked to share my story one time after I won the finale, and I was scared to death, but I got up and I shared my story at the Capitol building in Salt Lake City, Utah. And the next thing I know, I had, you know, a sheriff's department calling me, hey, we want you to come speak in the school. We've had 3 overdoses, you know. Hey, I want you to come speak at this place here, you know, and I want you to come speak here. And, you know, can you come speak here? And then I did a narcotics assembly. And then all the sheriff's departments started asking, you know, hey, will you come speak here? We can come do this. And then you've got alternative high schools where kids are already starting to struggle. So I started speaking there. And then I went to a prison. And then I went to a jail. And then I went to a drug treatment center, residential drug treatment center, then an outpatient drug treatment center. And my next one will be a week after my fight, April 16th. At the juvenile, it's the juvenile justice, everything has to do with juvenile justice in Utah. And for me, that'll be my end to juvenile justice, to kids who are struggling, to tell them, like, to not give up hope if they're struggling, because people like me can accomplish amazing things, but I can't do it when I'm on heroin, and I can't do it when I'm on pain pills. And a lot of people think, you know, like, oh, I'm never going to have fun again if I stop drinking and stop using. And I'm here to tell you that that's not the truth. Like, I've traveled the world. I'm competing in, you know, the best fighting organization in the world. For me, it doesn't seem that incredible. It doesn't seem that great. But for somebody who's strung out shooting dope in a meth lab trailer, you know, things are looking pretty grim. And I can tell you, I've been strung out in a meth lab trailer shooting heroin, thinking that my only option was to stick a gun in my mouth. And I didn't dare do that because I had an uncle who committed suicide, and I saw what it did to my family, so I couldn't put my family through that. So my only other option was to continue to use. And I managed to get some help that was offered, which led me on a path to live a life of recovery one day at a time. And, you know, so I share that. And it's just the feeling I have after I share that, and especially when I have kids come up to me and say, hey man, I'm struggling. What do I do? Well, what do you use? What are you doing? You know? And it's like, I can offer suggestions based on my own experience. Okay. Well, maybe, you know, if it's to a certain point, maybe we can find a treatment center that can get you in there. Maybe a 12-step meeting, or maybe they just need to talk to me, you know? So I don't know, man.
Wrapping up, I do have one final question for you, but could you let people know where could people contact you? What's the best way to try to book you if someone listening, you know, might have want help in that regard or want to book you for a talk?
They're updating my website right now, but go to CourtMcGee.com, and there's an email that you can contact if you have any questions regarding speaking appearances or seminars. But my big thing, speaking. And, you know, I never thought in a million years, on April 16th, if I stay sober one day at a time, I'll have 10 years of continued sobriety. Wow. And at 21 years old, I didn't ever, if you'd have told me 10 years ago that I'd be doing what I'm doing right now, I would have called you a liar. I would have sold myself short. So if you're struggling, there is a way out. Life can be better than you ever, ever could have imagined. So, and that's coming from, you know, a kid that grew up in Layton, Utah. Yeah. So,
well, Court, listen, we cannot thank you enough for the time. Your story is amazing. I'm glad it's being shared. We wish you good luck in your fight. Awesome, awesome anniversary
April
coming
16th.
Up here, April 16th.
UFC on Fox 19.
That is awesome. Good luck in the fight, and we really can't thank you enough for the time.
Yeah, hey, thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
All right, there you have it, Court McGee. As you said, Gumby, in the lead-up to the interview, a little bit different from what we're normally used to. Not so much the fight camp or the breakdown or, you know, fight strategy, but got a glimpse of the personal side of Court McGee. Super inspirational guy, passing on his message and trying to be inspirational to people who might suffer from the same addictions. And, you know, it was cool to hear.
Yeah, really cool to hear. And while we didn't get that other stuff too, it shouldn't go without being said that Court McGee is a hell of a fighter. And, you know, that side of his game is really impressive. Former Ultimate Fighter champion, you know, So definitely tune in and watch his fight. It's going to be a hell of a fight.
And that is at the Big Fox Show in mid-April.
That's correct.
All right. So with that said, thank you so much for joining us for episode 10. We didn't do any fanfare. We didn't do any hoopla for our double-digit episode. We just come to work. We get our elbows dirty. We, you know, we just put in work.
Yeah, we put in work. And to appreciate that work, hit us up on iTunes, TuneIn, SoundCloud. Hit us up on Stitcher. Hit us up on any of the podcast devices that you enjoy. And click the download button, give us a comment, and show us your appreciation.
And we appreciate you, our listeners, bringing us into your eardrums every week, however you get us, on MMAManifesto.com, TuneIn, Stitcher, iCloud, SoundCloud, whatever device you use to stream us. We appreciate it. You can also show your appreciation by following us on Twitter at TopTurtleMMA or emailing us your feedback to the show, both negative or positive. We'll take both, TopTurtleMMA@gmail.com. This was episode 10. There was no hoopla or fanfare, even though it was a double-digit episode, because that's just not the kind of guys me and Gumby are. We're hard workers. We come, we get dirty, we roll up our sleeves, we go to work. We don't need any big pats on the back or, oh man, episode 10, episode 100, let's throw a party. Not our style. We're just here to provide you with a quality show. I don't know why I feel like I'm cutting a wrestling promo right now, but I do. When you get to the top turtle position in MMA, you should always be looking to finish. We are Top Turtle. Thank God we're finished.